All right, we're underway with the recorder, so let's get underway with a little bit of review. Question? Oh, we need a, okay, yes, I have one notebook. One notebook, sir, here you go. You got my last one. Come on, yeah. Could you have him register to Craig? Just fill out one side of this registration form, sir. Will, could you show him how to register? Thank you. Page 21 in your outline. All right. Let's see where we were. Last week, we were introduced to the genealogies, the section of Scripture that 21st century Americans hate, the boring genealogies. And I'm hoping to instill in you the understanding of how important the genealogies are. We began by sharing with you a portion of a letter that a young Palestinian Christian wrote to me from prison. And in that letter, he wrote this: "Let me give you my bloodline so that by my custom you can know me." Again, Yosef didn't feel that I could really know who he was unless I knew his roots. And the same is true with Jesus. That's good biblical and Middle Eastern thinking. We can't really know who Jesus is unless we know his roots, his Jewish roots. And unfortunately, the church is divorcing itself from the Jewish roots of the New Testament at a rapid pace these days, which is unfortunate. But the genealogies give us a glimpse into Yeshua's roots. Now, the genealogies are very closely connected to the covenants of the Bible. And I pointed out to you last week that the Abrahamic covenant is an eternal and unconditional covenant God made with the Jewish people, containing three promises: the land promise, the national promise, and a spiritual blessing promise. And those three promises are expanded and developed by three additional eternal and unconditional covenants God made with the Jewish people: the land covenant, the Davidic covenant, and the new covenant. And the genealogies are concerned most primarily with the national promise and the Davidic covenant. Then we looked at the Davidic covenant, and we saw that David was promised four eternal aspects to this covenant: an eternal house, an eternal throne, an eternal kingdom, and an eternal person. It's promised to David. And the genealogies consist, or I should say, focus in on, most importantly, on the house, the eternal house, David's family, the succession of kings that will come from David. All right, that I also mentioned that there are two requirements for kingship in the Bible. One is Davidic descent. Whoever sits on Israel's throne needs to be of the house of David. And the second requirement is a divine appointment. And I asked the question, why would divine appointment be necessary for Yeshua? Well, for two reasons, I think. First of all, he's going to be king over a united Israel, not over the northern kingdom and not over the southern kingdom, but over a united Israel. And secondly, there were many potential claimants for the throne floating around in Israel in the first century. There were lots of them. So the question would arise, which descendant of David has God chosen to be king over Israel, to be the Messiah king? And we'll look at that in a little more detail. So at this point, we're going to start into Matthew's genealogy and see how both biblical requirements for kingship play a role in the life of the Messiah. So we're at page 21. At the top of the page, we were introduced to Matthew's genealogy. It's the genealogy of Joseph. He breaks Jewish custom by inserting the names of women into the genealogy. He skips names. That's because symmetry is his focus. But those are minor issues compared to the purpose of Matthew's genealogy. And that is to show that Joseph is not Yeshua's father in any way, shape, or form. He is absolutely not Yeshua's father. And again, just to repeat the normal interpretation of Matthew's genealogy, a lot of good commentaries and a lot of good men explain the genealogies in this manner. that Luke gives us the Messiah's real lineage, while Matthew gives us his royal lineage. And the statement is made that Joseph is heir apparent to the Davidic throne. And that's in spite of the fact that there were many, many descendants of David floating around in the first century. And secondly, they make the statement that because Jesus was his adopted son, he could claim the throne through Joseph, in spite of the fact that there's not one word that says Jesus was adopted by Joseph. There's no evidence to support that assertion. So I think it's a rather weak position. And again, like I said, a lot of good men hold to it. But my warning to you last week was what? I am not a good man. Okay? I do not hold to this position. I will explain my position to you in detail. But you're in the class of a rabble-rouser here. So, you ready for this? Rabbi Rouser. Yeah. You and Roger. Back to the back of the room. Your replacement is here, Roger. Okay. I'm in trouble, you guys. Pray for me. All right. Two reasons why I don't agree with this position. Let's start with this idea of adoption. And these two slides are at the bottom of page 21. We'll put the slides up on the screen. You can read them there, or you can read them on your outline. But this is excerpts from the Jewish or the Encyclopedia Judaica on the topic of adoption. What do we read in those articles, or in this article? The evidence for adoption in the Bible is so equivocal, and that word means vague, that some have denied it was practiced in the biblical period. The evidence for adoption in the pre-exilic period is meager. So we're talking about the period prior to the exile to Babylon, prior to 586 BC. The possibility that adoption was practiced in this period cannot be excluded, especially since contemporary legal documents are lacking. So they don't want to make an argument from silence. Nevertheless, it seems that if adoption played any role at all in Israelite family institutions, it was an insignificant one. All right, now we move to the next period. For the post-exilic period, and that's from 586 onward, after the Babylonian exile, for the post-exilic period in Israel, there is no reliable evidence for adoption at all. No reliable evidence. Now, as you go down that article, you come to the next slide, and the subtitle, Adoption in Later Jewish Law. Adoption is not known as a legal institution in Jewish law. According to halakha, now that's the Hebrew for Jewish law, basically. According to halakha, the personal status of a parent and child is based on the natural family relationship only, and there is no recognized way of creating this status artificially by a legal act or fiction. However, Jewish law does provide for consequences essentially similar to those caused by adoption to be created by legal means. These consequences are the right and obligation of a person to assume responsibility for a child's physical and mental welfare, and B, his financial position, including matters of inheritance and maintenance. All right, what's the impact of this information? The import of this information is that Joseph could have easily assumed responsibility for Yeshua. Joseph was legally able to provide for Jesus and to oversee his physical, mental, financial welfare as his guardian, but not as an adopted father. Question?
With regards to the word adoption, Paul clearly uses that in the New Testament. So where does he draw that?
Out of his Greek Gentile background. Okay. Remember, Paul is a Jew living, raised in Tarsus. Then he came to Jerusalem and studied under Gamaliel. And he is going out into a Gentile-dominated world. Okay? Question?
Jesus was a man of sorrows. If you read 69 from the point of view that the the town he grew up in thought he was illegitimate. That Psalm 69, I mean, it says he was I am the song of the drunkards. And it says other things in there.
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of controversy swirled around Yeshua and around this whole topic that we're going to discuss. And so that's why Matthew hits that objection right on at the beginning, because I'm sure he witnessed Yeshua deal with these questions. Well, is he illegitimate? Is Joseph his father? His father, being his father, is even, that's the misconception, the common misconception. And it was fueled even by his mother. Remember in the temple when he's 12 years old? He says, why have you done this to your father and I? What does Jesus do in the temple? Immediately he corrects her. Don't you know I must be about my father's business? Joseph's not my father. He immediately corrects her there. So this was a common misconception that we'll see all the time throughout the Gospels. And I'm sure Jesus dealt with it. I'm sure Matthew witnessed him dealing with it. And so Matthew brings this problem out before a Jewish audience immediately, because this is a major problem.
I was just thinking of him growing up in a small town.
Sure.
There's lots of rumors. And
sure.
And
oh, yeah.
Would Mary and Joseph have explained it? I mean, how could they explain it?
Well, exactly. He was very controversial. Very controversial. And this is one of the controversies. So Matthew dives into this to explain to everybody that Joseph is not Yeshua's father. Well, who was his father? God is his father. That's the reason it comes out right at the forefront, because it's designed for the Jewish audience. Okay? Make sense? All right. Any other thoughts there? All right. That's why I will probably be cutting your break a little short, because there will probably be a lot more questions like this as we go through this. All righty. So, Joseph could be his guardian, but not his adopted father. But that would not have qualified Yeshua for the throne of David through Joseph, even if he was adopted by him. Jesus had no claim to the throne if he was linked to Joseph as Joseph's son in some way. Why? Again, that's part of the reason for the genealogy. He's going to present a problem, and then he's going to solve the problem with the virgin birth. Okay? Now, Luke will have no such problem. Luke is not writing primarily to a Jewish audience. So he's going to start with the virgin birth, and he's going to bring in the genealogy three chapters later. That's because Luke's audience is different. But Matthew has a Jewish audience. So let's take a look at Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. We're now at page 22 at the top of your outline, and we're picking it up in your harmony at section 3. This is page 20, section 3 in the middle of the page, the left-hand column, Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. Okay, everybody there? All right, chapter 1, verse 1. The book of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Now that's an introductory verse. It's a summary phrase, and it connects the early events of the Messiah's life with the Jewish covenants. And we talked about those covenants last week, four unconditional and eternal covenants made with the Jewish people: Abrahamic, land, Davidic, and new covenant. And two of them are in view here. The phrase son of David connects him with the Davidic covenant. And the phrase son of Abraham connects him with the Abrahamic covenant. And now note, please note that the term son of David, son of Abraham, means descendant. That's just a Hebraic way of saying descendant. He's not trying to say that David or Abraham literally conceived Yeshua. All right, let's drop down to verse 2. To Abraham was born Yitzhak, and to Yitzhak Yaakov, and to Yaakov Yehuda and his brothers. And to Yehuda was born Peretz and Zerah by Tamar, and to Peretz was born Hetzron, and to Hetzron Ram. So in verse 3, we come across the mention of Tamar, a woman. Verses 4 and 5. And to Ram was born Amminadab, and to Amminadab Nachshon, and to Nachshon Salmon. And to Salmon was born Boaz by Rahab, And to Boaz was born Obed by Ruth, and to Obed, Jesse. Now in verse 5, notice Rahab and Ruth, two more women. He's breaking tradition right and left here. And finally, verse 6. And to Jesse was born David the king, and to David was born Solomon by her who had been the wife of Uriah. And of course, that is an indirect reference to Bathsheba. Bathsheba. Now, four women are referred to, and at least three, possibly all four, are Gentiles. So that's another break with tradition. Ruth was a Moabitess. Ruth was from Moab. Tamar was a Canaanite. Rahab was a Canaanite. Although I think Bathsheba was probably Jewish, but she may have been a Gentile as well. We're not sure there. So we have three, possibly all four, are Gentiles. Women and Gentiles. Question. Right. No, I'm not. Okay. No, I'm not. Sorry. Okay. I'll look that up. You come up at the break and write out your question, and I'll look it up.
Okay.
All righty. Now, three of these women, well, why would he include women and Gentiles? Well, Matthew is already pointing out that although Jesus came as king of the Jews, and the Jews would primarily benefit, Gentiles would benefit as well. So the ministry of the Messiah is not limited to the Jewish community. In addition, three of these four women are guilty of sexual sin. Rahab was a prostitute. Tamar was guilty of incest. Bathsheba, guilty of adultery. Ruth is a bright and shining light there, isn't she? So what's the point of including sinners in the Messiah's genealogy? To stress that Jesus came to save sinners. Now, these ladies are all pre-Davidic ancestors of Jesus. Of course, Bathsheba is married to David. But basically, this part of the line is all prior to David. But these two points are not the main point of the genealogy. No particular problems exist prior to David. So we need to continue on in Matthew's genealogy. And I'm going to direct your attention to diagram number one there at the bottom of page 2, page 22. The two genealogies compared. I'm going to graph them out, and on the right side you're going to see Luke's genealogy, and on the left side you're going to see Matthew's genealogy, and we're going to put them out there side by side for you. So let's start with Matthew. Now Matthew traces Joseph's genealogy in verse 2, beginning with Abraham, down to verse 6 in David. And David, we've read those six verses. So let's add this information to the chart. We start with Abraham. We come down to David. Then Matthew chooses one of David's sons, and David had a lot of sons. You'll see that in a moment. He chooses Solomon. And from Solomon, Matthew traces Joseph's genealogy down to verse 11 and a man called Jeconiah. Now, verse 11 is on page 21 of your harmony, in the left-hand column, verses 9, 10, and 11. And to Josiah was born Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon. Then he continues down to verse 16 and to Joseph. So let's add in Jeconiah here below Solomon. And then verse 16. And to Jacob was born Joseph, the husband of Mary, by whom was born Jesus, who is called the Messiah, who is called the Christ. So let's add in Joseph below Jeconiah. Now, Before we go any further, I need to point out to you that in verse 16, Joseph's name is highly qualified. He's called the husband of Mary by whom was born Jesus. And this is the second chart at the bottom of page 22. Now, in Greek, we have a masculine gender, a feminine gender, and a neuter. And as Matthew goes through the genealogy, as he's describing the men here, he's using the masculine gender. To Jacob was born Joseph, the husband of. All in the masculine gender because he's speaking of men, right? Now he switches over to the feminine gender, the husband of Mary, because she's feminine, of course. But then he remains in the feminine gender by whom? By Mary was born Jesus, who is called Messiah. He is very, very carefully saying that Jesus was born of Mary, not of Joseph. That little bit of Greek grammar tells us who Matthew is referring to, Mary. So the left column, we have direct descendants, Jacob, Joseph. And in the right column, we have direct descendants, Mary, Jesus. Okay, does that make sense? He's focusing in on Mary. All right, so we're told very clearly here, back to our other chart, that Joseph is a direct descendant of Jeconiah, and that is a problem. That is a critical issue. And the critical issue surfaces in Jeremiah chapter 22, verse 24. Jeremiah 22:24. So that's up on the screen. Let's see what the issue is. Jeremiah 22:24. As I live, declares the Lord, even though Coniah, that's a shortened form of Jeconiah. You know, my full name is Robert, but you call me Bob. Same thing, okay? As I live, declares the Lord, even though Coniah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, were a signet ring on my right hand, yet I would pull you off, and I will give you over into the hand of those who are seeking your life. Yes, into the hand of those whom you dread, even into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of the Chaldeans. I will hurl you and your mother, who bore you, into another country where you were not born, and there you will die. Not exactly a pleasant message to Coniah, is it? I don't think I'd like to be on the receiving end of this. But as for the land to which they desire to return, they will not return to it. Is this man Coniah a despised, shattered jar? Or is he an undesirable vessel? The answer is yes. He's not very desirable, is he? Why have he and his descendants been hurled out and cast into a land that is not known? O land, 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 hear the word of the Lord. And here comes what's known as the Jeconiah curse. Thus says the Lord, write this man down childless, Jeconiah, Coniah, a man who will not prosper in his days, for no man of his descendants will prosper sitting on the throne of David and ruling again in Judah. All right, because of the man Jeconiah was, because of the kind of man Jeconiah was, he was an evil king. Jeremiah pronounces this curse upon him. And the curse says that no descendant of Jeconiah will ever have the right to sit on the throne. Now, we've just been told that Joseph is a direct descendant of Jeconiah. That's our problem. Joseph was not the heir apparent to the throne of David. He was not the heir apparent, and Jesus, if he was linked to Joseph, could not be king, because Joseph could not be king. The Jeconiah curse cut off his right to the throne. And Jesus would have fallen under the Jeconiah curse, and that's why Matthew starts out with this genealogy. He's going to solve this problem with the virgin birth. He's going to tell us in no uncertain terms that Jesus was not really born of Joseph. Joseph looked after his welfare, but he was not Yeshua's father. So while initially the Bible required for kingship a descendant of David, in Jeremiah's day, this requirement was narrowed. To be king, you had to be a member of the house of David, but apart from Jeconiah. So that's what Matthew is saying. Jesus is apart from Jeconiah. He has nothing to do with that curse. That's the first part of Matthew's answer in the genealogy. All right. Now turn to page 23. And let's read the last verse of Matthew's genealogy on page 21 of your harmony, verse 17, the bottom of that left-hand column. Therefore, all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the time of Messiah, 14 generations. Now look on with me at the top paragraph under the title, The 14 Generations. Matthew gives us instructions. This is on your outline. This is on page 23, top of page 23. Matthew gives us instructions how to interpret his 14 generations in verse 17. And verse 17 is located on the right-hand column of this chart, broken into three parts there. Do you see verse 17? That's the interpretive grid. Between keywords, highlighted in bold, we find 14 generations. A possible reason why Matthew chose the number 14 lies in the fact that the numerical value of the name David, in Hebrew equals 14. Now, for those of you that are not familiar with Hebrew, this is your first Hebrew lesson. There's David's name in Hebrew. This is a dalet, a D sound. This is a vav, a V sound. This is a dalet. This is an A sound, and this is an E sound. These are the vowel points down here. So you read Hebrew from left to right and up and down. A little different from English, right? Right to left, excuse me. Right to left and up and down. Exactly the opposite of English. That's why Hebrew is so hard for English people to get. It's a difficult class. Okay, so you read this, David. Okay, David, okay, as it comes into English. Now, let's spread out the letters a little bit so you can see them. Every letter in Hebrew has a numerical value. D, dalet, has a numerical value of 4. Vav has a numerical value of 6. Dalet has a numerical value of 4. You add them together, and what do you get? Voila, 14. Okay, that is a possible reason why he is being symmetrical around this number 14. Question?
Are those numerical values because of where they fall?
Yes, where they fall in the alphabet. Dalet is the fourth letter. Vav is the sixth letter. It changes when you get to, I forget which letter, but the first majority of the first letters are that way. Yes?
Without creating a digression, hopefully, the frame of reference that you just introduced is a key consideration to the Kabbalah. Numerical designation to each letter, and therefore the interpretation from a numerical point of view adds to the authenticity and the translatability of every passage by a scribe or by a rabbi. They have to have it numerically correct or it's incorrect.
Right, the gematria it's called.
That's right.
Yeah, and it's not exactly. It's a rabbinic interpretive term, but it is really the wrong way to go about interpreting Scripture. But yeah, the rabbis are into it.
But nevertheless, it is an authenticating framework.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's an authenticating framework. Definitely.
So I wonder whether it should be accentuated in discussion or diminished. Because if it's authenticating in this regard, it's authenticating in every regard.
No, it's not. It's just not necessarily. I wouldn't take it that far, Roger. Okay? I wouldn't take it that far.
Okay.
All righty. So that's possibly a reason why he's doing this. Remember the number 7? Remember the number 7 speaks of completeness, speaks of sacredness. 3 is associated with God, etc. So Matthew could simply be saying to us here that he is trying to put together a sacred and complete and organized genealogy of the Messiah.
Yeah, I
That's as far as I would take it.
So far as the Old Testament is concerned, written in Hebrew, contextually in this frame of reference, you would have to consider the numerical designation. In the New Testament, you're dealing in Greek, and so...
Well, we're not doing an interpretation here of meaning. We're just pointing out that he's got symmetry in his background. Symmetry is his goal here. Why would he want to use symmetry? Because he's speaking to a Jewish audience, and he's trying to point out that this is a holy genealogy. No, we can leave it at that, I think. All righty. Now, take a look at the three generations of 14 each. We start with the book of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah. And you see 14 names from Abraham down to David the king as verse 17. He tells us exactly what he's meaning here. All the generations from Abraham to David were 14. Then the next division, David, and then between David and at the bottom there, the deportation to Babylon, you see 14 names, Solomon to Jeconiah. And Matthew then explains it from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations. And then the bottom section, verse 12, after the deportation to Babylon, to the word Christ, the Messiah, you have 14 names, Jeconiah down to Jesus. And that's Matthew's final explanation, from the deportation of Babylon to the time of Christ, 14 generations. So he very carefully lays out the genealogy in that symmetrical way. Okay. Now, let me summarize this a little bit as far as we've gone. Matthew is presenting Yeshua's genealogy in relation to his guardian, Joseph. And remember, Joseph is an honorable man. He's a good man. He's a man of high character. He's a direct descendant of King David through Solomon. But he is not Yeshua's father, verse 16. He is Mary's husband. He is Yeshua's guardian, and that's why he's important. He was given a great privilege and a great responsibility. But Joseph is not the heir apparent to the throne. Because he's under the Jeconiah curse, he had no legal right to sit on David's throne. And if Yeshua had been his son in some way, Yeshua would have been disqualified from the messianic office by the Jeconiah curse. Question?
But Joseph had other sons.
Just a second. I've got a question going here. Joseph, yes, Joseph had other sons, yeah.
So he wasn't childless.
No, he and Mary, we'll get to that. He and Mary had other children. Susan, did you ask a question?
Yes, I was going to ask why, but I'm thinking, would he have included Joseph's genealogy, because it's just proof that Jesus doesn't.
Yeah, that's what he's doing, yeah.
That's the main point,
yeah. That's the most critical point. Okay, Joseph was the husband of Yeshua's mother and the guardian of Yeshua, but that is as far as it went. Yeshua is not impacted by the Jeconiah curse. It does not concern Yeshua. That's the most important point that he wants to bring out. All righty, let's turn to page 24 of your outline, top of the page. And let's start into Luke's genealogy. We have a minute or so, we can start into that. Luke is very different from Matthew. He follows strict Jewish law. He mentions no women. He doesn't even mention Mary, although that's the line he is tracing. He skips no names. Symmetry is not his focus. Historical chronology is. So that's why he writes in a very different style. He's writing to a different audience, to a Greek audience. And he shows that Jesus could still be king because Jesus is a descendant of David, but apart from the house of Jeconiah. And again, that's why he starts the gospel differently. He deals with the genealogy later because he doesn't have to deal with this Jeconiah problem. So why don't we go ahead and take a break at this point? And I'm going to give you a 10-minute break, because we've already had a lot of questions and there may be more to come, and I don't want to keep you too much over our time period. So go ahead and take your break and listen for the shofar.
Yes.
All right, we're back underway again. All right, and we're picking it up at section 3 of the harmony. We're going to read Luke chapter 3, verses 23 and 24. That's page 20 of your harmony, the right-hand column. Section 3. If you have the NIV, it's different. Yeah, if you have the NIV translation, this is the New American Standard. So you have a brown copy of the harmony that's NIV, you're going to have to look around for this. Okay. Being supposedly the son of Joseph, the son of Heli, the son of Mathat, the son of Levi, the son of Melchi, the son of Janai, the son of Yosef. All right. I want to refer you to the chart in the middle of the page on page 24. Here's the chart, and we'll build this piece by piece. Now, as you look on the, if you look on the left-hand column, Luke has a list of names, and here's another little Greek lesson for you. Every one of those names has the Greek definite article in front of it, with the exception of the name Joseph. So as you read the top there, you see the genealogy of Jesus being supposedly the son of Joseph. There's no definite article, no word the before Joseph. But then the list starts, the son of the Heli, the son of the Mathat, the son of the Levi, the son of the Melchi. Perfectly fine Greek, rotten English, but perfectly fine Greek. So what is happening here? Luke is deliberately using a literary device to set off the name Joseph. He's trying to emphasize Joseph's name. So what does that tell us? That tells us that the better way of rendering the verse is to put a parenthesis around the phrase, supposedly the son of Joseph. So on my chart, I'm going to add the parentheses in here. So there it is. We now have a parenthetical phrase. That's the idea. All right, so a parenthetical phrase can be taken out of the context because it's just a little bit of additional information. Well, what is the additional information that Matthew is trying to tell us here? He's trying to point out to us the popular misunderstanding of the day. Let's add in that information. The popular misunderstanding of the day was that Jesus was the son of Joseph. Supposedly the son of Joseph. Okay, so highlight that thought in your mind. Mark it in fluorescent yellow. Thank you, Susan. Mark it on your mental, with your mental highlighter. This is the popular misunderstanding. And that is why we're going to see it occur over and over and over again. So this is a key issue. Everyone thought that Joseph was Yeshua's father. They thought he had a human natural father like everyone else. They didn't assume that he was adopted because adoption was not practiced in first century Israel. So they made the assumption that Joseph was his father. What would that do? That would disqualify him from the throne. So Matthew has dealt with that issue. In his genealogy, Joseph is not Yeshua's father. Well, that raises the question, well, then who is his father? And, of course, Matthew's going to answer that with the virgin birth. God is Yeshua's father. That's Matthew's answer, but there's another question that would be raised. If Joseph is not his father, then does Yeshua have a legitimate link to the Davidic throne? And Luke is going to answer affirmatively. Yes, Yeshua does have a legitimate link to the throne of David. So let's see how he does this. All right, I've taken out the parenthetical additional information just to make it a little clearer. And so the genealogy reads, Jesus being the son of the Heli, or Eli or Haley. Now, who is this guy, Eli or Haley? He is Mary's father. This is the key. He is Mary's father. Luke is not going to mention women. He's going to follow tradition. No, he's not going to mention Mary. So he's going to mention her father. Now, it's not unique. And in Jewish writings, we do find a reference by the rabbis to this fella, Heli. John Lightfoot, for example. Do I have that down there for you? No. John Lightfoot, in his commentary on the New Testament from the Talmud and Hebraica, records this excerpt from the Jerusalem Talmud, Haggigah, folio 77, 4, or D. There is a discourse of a certain person who in his sleep saw the punishment of the damned. He saw Mary, the daughter of Heli, amongst the shades. Rabbi Yoash bar Hanina saith that the great bar of hell's gate hung at her ear. Now, why would this Mary, this person Mary, be so despised? Why would she be recorded in the Talmud as in the place of the damned, and not only in the place of the damned, but suffering more than most, the great bar of hell's gate hanging from an ear? And they even say more that is so graphic, I felt it wasn't proper to show it to you here. Why? You know, well, that's because our Mary, daughter of Heli, gave birth to Yeshua. So there's a certain number of commentators that feel that this is a reference to Mary, the mother of Yeshua. Dr. Fruchtenbaum agrees with this. Some scholars disagree. R. Travers Herford, in his book Christianity in the Talmud and Midrash, thinks it's unlikely. But I know of no other Mary who would be so reviled in Jewish history. Who else would this be referring to? I know of no one else. So we probably have a reference to Mary here as the daughter of Heli. Now, it's also not unique in Jewish systems to trace a man's origin through his wife. We do have an example in the Bible in Nehemiah 7:36, repeated in Ezra 2:61. That little genealogy reads, "Of the priests, the son of Hobiah, the sons of Hakoz, the sons of Barzillai, who took a wife from the daughters of Barzillai, the Gileadite, and was named after them." So here we have a man whose origin is not traced through his real line, but through his wife's line. And he's named after the daughters of Barzillai. So it does happen. It isn't common, but it does happen. And remember, this is because Mary is not being mentioned here because tradition does not mention women's names in genealogy. And Luke is following Jewish tradition here. So he can't mention Mary's name, so he mentions her father. So he is tracing Mary's line. And this is in keeping with the entire gospel that tells the story from Mary's viewpoint, not Joseph's. Now, Luke does something different for us. He traces the genealogy in reverse order from Matthew. So now we're at the chart at the bottom of page 24. And so from Jesus to God, he goes in the opposite direction here. He traces the line backward in time. So he's going to use God as a bookend at either end of his genealogy. Now in verse 31, we come to Nathan and David. So we're in the right-hand column, section 3. Verse 31 is the bottom of page 20, the right-hand column. The son of Meleah, the son of Mena, the son of Matatha, the son of Nathan, the son of David. So Luke also traces the genealogy back to David, but David had another son, Nathan. So let's add Nathan into the mix here. He traces the genealogy back to Nathan. Now David's line through Solomon ended with a Jeconiah curse that excluded Joseph and his descendants from David's throne. Now the reason this occurs lies in a principle that many commentators overlook. so few of them go into this issue. So now we're on lesson 1, page 25. So many commentators say that the Davidic line has to come through Solomon. And that's why they're committed to that viewpoint. And that's why they come up with this supposition that Joseph was the heir apparent and that David, that Jesus was adopted. But they ignore this principle. And the principle is the top of page 25. The Davidic covenant is unconditional for David, but it is conditional for Solomon. And it is conditional for Solomon and his descendants. So the Davidic king will be the Davidic covenant will be fulfilled for David without question. But the descendant through whom the line will be fulfilled is conditional upon the obedience of the descendant and those who follow him. So there are key biblical statements that are usually not mentioned. So 1 Chronicles 22, 6 through 13, for example. Let's read 1 Chronicles 22, 13. Notice the conditional aspect. Then you will prosper, he's speaking to Solomon here, then you will prosper if you are careful to observe the statutes and the ordinances which the Lord commanded Moses concerning Israel. So David says to his son Solomon, be strong and courageous, do not fear, nor be dismayed. So David is explaining to Solomon that he's going to prosper only if he's obedient to the law of Moses. Let's take a look at 1 Kings 11:9. The question we have to ask is, was Solomon obedient to the law of Moses? What's the answer to that? No. 1 Kings 11:9. Now the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. So Solomon is not going to prosper. He's breaking the Mosaic law. He's not following it diligently. He's going to be disciplined. Now let's take a look at 1 Chronicles 28, verse 7. David is explaining his understanding of the Davidic covenant to Solomon. Excuse me, God is explaining the covenant to Solomon. I, and that's God speaking, I will establish his kingdom, he's referring to Solomon, I will establish his kingdom forever if he resolutely performs my commandments and my ordinances as is done now. Notice the conditional element. I will establish if. Okay, so it appears to me that the Davidic covenant is conditional in regard to Solomon. And again, did Solomon follow the Mosaic law diligently? No, no. Now, 1 Kings 9, 3. Excuse me, 1 Kings 9, 4 through 7. Again, we have a promise and warning to Solomon. And we're now down in about the middle of the page, 1 Kings 9, 3 through 7. God speaking, as for you, if you, Solomon, if you will walk before me, and that's God speaking, as your father David walked, in integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I have commanded you, and will keep my statutes and my ordinances, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever, just as I promised to your father David, saying, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. But if you or your sons indeed turn away from following me and do not keep my commandments and my statutes, which I have sent before you, and go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them and the house which I have consecrated for my name, and I will cast out of my sight. And so Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all the peoples. So if Solomon had resolutely followed the Mosaic law and been obedient, he would have received an unconditional promise as well. The line would have come through him, and history would have been different. but he didn't. All right, add to your list there. Add one more. Psalm 89, 28 through 37. Psalm 89, 28 through 37, up on the screen. Add this to your notes. One more psalm, one more section, highlighting the conditional nature of the Davidic covenant to David's descendant, but the fact that it is unconditional to David. Psalm 89, 28. My loving kindness I will keep for him. He's speaking of David here. I will keep for him forever, and my covenant shall be confirmed to him, to David. So I will establish his descendants forever and his throne as the days of heaven. If his sons forsake my law and do not walk in my judgments, if they violate my statutes and do not keep my commandments, then I will punish their transgressions with the rod and their iniquity with stripes. But I will not break off my loving kindness from him, from David. No matter what his descendants do, the covenant is going to be fulfilled through David. Nor deal falsely in my faithfulness. My covenant I will not violate, nor will I alter the utterance of my lips. Once I have sworn by my holiness, I will not lie to David. His descendant shall endure forever, and his throne as the sun before me. It shall be established forever like the moon, and the witness in the sky is faithful. Selah. Think about it. All right. God is going to fulfill his promise to David of an eternal house, an eternal throne, an eternal person, an eternal kingdom. And it will only come through Solomon's line if Solomon's line is worthy. Solomon's line was not worthy, and it was cut off at the Jeconiah curse. So a transfer of the Davidic covenant, the covenant promise, to another descendant of David is required. And that's where Luke's genealogy comes into play. Now, did the descendants of Solomon resolutely follow the Mosaic covenant? Turn to the next page. Page 26, you get a list of the kings of Judah, all of them. And the character of those kings is in the center column. That's the column I want you to look at. What was the character of those kings? 12 were bad, 8 were good. Solomon's line has a dismal record of performance when it comes to the Mosaic covenant. That's why they were judged. Okay? Solomon's line was disciplined and disqualified. Look at number 19, Jeconiah. He was one of the worst. He was so bad that God pronounced the Jeconiah curse on him. Number 19. What about his successor, Zedekiah, his son? Zedekiah did not prosper under Babylon's domination. Zedekiah revolted, was defeated, and he brought on the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. Zedekiah actually brought on the destruction of Jerusalem. Okay, so God has to fulfill his promise to David. Eternal house, eternal throne, eternal person, eternal kingdom. It's not going to come through Solomon's line. He's got to transfer it to another son. But which son? Go to page 27, top of the page. That same chart is on the overhead. Which son of David? David had a bunch of sons. There they are on the chart. At the top is his wives. All across the top is his wives. All right? Then below the wives are some of the sons. Amnon, Kileab, Absalom, Adonijah, Shephatiah, Ithream. Here's Bathsheba. Shimeah, Shobab, Nathan, Solomon, other wives. And here we have Ibhar, Elishama, Eliphelet, Noga, Nepheg, Yafia, Elishama, Eliada, Eliphelet. Here's a daughter, Tamar, and from concubines, other sons. Son after son after son, grandson after grandson, great son, grandson after. There was a bunch of descendants of David in the first century. Hundreds of them. Hundreds. We don't know how many. Which one is going to be king? All right. Well, let's take a look. Here's Solomon. Solomon has been disobedient. Here's his mother, Bathsheba, so Solomon is cut off. So what does God do? He simply moves to the second-born son of Bathsheba, to Nathan. That's as simple as that. He transfers this to the second-born son of Bathsheba. And there's no blood of Jeconiah in the veins of Nathan. The transfer is then made to Nathan's line. Simple as that. No. That was a prophet. Totally different guy. So the transfer is made at the Jeconiah curse over to Nathan's line, down to Haley, and of course he is Mary's father, and God, Mary, and Jesus. Now, Jesus is then a member of the house of David, but it's apart from Jeconiah, and so he can be king. There's the line. Mary's line on the left-hand side. God to Abraham, to David, to Nathan, down to Heli, down to Mary, down to Jesus. He can be king.
Did the H not get on there?
Yeah, Haley or Ailey, yeah, it's just a variant in spelling there. Variant in spelling, like Bob and Bobby, you know, Robert and Rob, or Robert and R-O-B-T, period. You know, same kind of thing. We do it all the time in English. All right. Now, I know a number of you are ready to throw tomatoes at me. This is a little different position than you normally hear. But I'm not going to duck your tomatoes. I'm going to give you one more verse. And this verse really put the final nail in the coffin, as far as I was concerned, concerning this position. And it's Zechariah 12, 10 through 12. It's not in your notes. Zechariah 12, 10 through 12. This is a second coming prophecy. This has not occurred yet. We're looking to the future here. And if you're not familiar with Messianic prophecy, we'll try to have a class on that one of these days. Zechariah 12, 10 through 12. God is speaking. I will pour out on what? The house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. So generically, the Jewish people, but specifically the house of David. What does that mean? There are members of the house of David among us today. Not all of us know what tribe we're from. Maybe I'm a descendant of David. I don't know which tribe I'm from. That'd be nice. I'd like to think of that. There are members of the house of David among us today. Because in the future, God's Spirit is going to be poured out upon them. Okay? I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication, so they will look on me, this is God, whom they have pierced. They've pierced God. And they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son, and they will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping over a firstborn. In that day, there will be great mourning in Jerusalem, like the mourning of Hadad-Rimmon on the plain of Megiddo. The land will mourn, every family by itself, the family of the house of David by itself, and their wives by themselves. So they're focusing here on the house of David. Tremendous, unusual mourning. And then notice the last phrase. And the family of the house of Nathan by itself, and their wives by themselves. What does that tell us? Descendants of Nathan live among us today. We don't know who they are, but Nathan is the prominent Davidic line at the second coming. He doesn't say the family of the house of Solomon. The line was transferred from Solomon to Nathan. Zechariah tells us the family of the house of Nathan is going to be the prominent Davidic family at the second coming. That makes sense? You would think if Solomon still was the prominent family, he would have been mentioned here and his line would have been preserved. All right? Any questions? Zechariah was written post-exile. He's a post-exilic prophet after the exile. He was written about 400, 500 years before Messiah came. Okay? Question?
It's interesting that they were more every family
these family groups will be able to identify themselves. And so the house of David, a family group, is going to be gathered together, and they're going to say, Jesus, he's the Messiah. We've rejected him all these years. And Nathan, yeah, Yeah, they're going to know who they are. They're going to know who they are. They're going to be forming little groups, and Nathan's group especially, because they're going to be saying, he's from our family, and we've been rejecting him all these years. Can you imagine the mourning that's going to happen? House of David, he's from our family. But of course, he's right from the line of Nathan, so that's even more personal. Did I see a question? Yes. I don't quite understand your question there, Jim. Okay, you can talk with me afterward, okay? I'm not quite sure what you're driving at there. Okay, I'm sorry. One more question. Yes, exactly, yes. Yeah, Solomon disobeyed the Mosaic Covenant when the Mosaic Covenant said the king shall not add to himself wives and chariots. Well, he broke that one big time, okay? He broke that one big time. Interesting, David is never criticized. David is never criticized, but Solomon is. So David had plenty of wives too, but... He said to, yeah, he said, I would have given you your more wives than that, yeah. So I can't speak to that one. All righty. All righty. Let's continue on here. I've only got about 5 minutes. All right, we're at page 28 at the top. Page 28 at the top. We're going to summarize this. I've got 5 points there. Now remember, Jesus was not the only descendant of David at this time. There were many potential Davidic claimants to the throne in the first century. In fact, point three, in 70 AD, 40 years after the time of Yeshua, General Vespasian, the Roman general, hunted down and executed the house of David during the first Jewish revolt. He tried to root out the entire house of David because there were many claimants to the throne floating around. And he was not interested in a Davidic descendant being proclaimed king and starting another revolt. So he hunted down the house of David. He wasn't successful, obviously, but he had a very specific reason for doing that. He had a lot of potential kings there. But the important point right now is that Luke gives us the Messiah's genealogy, showing us that Jesus was of the house of David apart from Jeconiah and therefore a legitimate claimant to the throne. And point five, the royal credentials of Jesus were impeccable. If they were not impeccable, he could have been easily dismissed as an obvious imposter. But nobody challenges this. All right, this does not solve the entire problem of Luke's genealogy. Why? Because claimants continue to emerge, even up to today. One of the major claimant that I mentioned is in 135 AD. The leader of the second Jewish revolt, Bar Kokhba, was of Davidic descent. So there's still descendants of David floating around. In fact, in 1992... just a few years ago, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson of the Chabad movement claimed Davidic descent. And that's why his followers called him King Messiah. Okay? So Jesus is a descendant of David from the house of Nathan. No blood of Jeconiah is in his veins. And today there's Rabbi Schneerson. Back in about 1992. He died in 1996. And when he was living, this is what you saw. regarding him. Here is a poster, and what does it say? Mashiach is on his way. Many Chabadniks considered him the Messiah. Here is a little button they would wear. Mashiach, we want Mashiach now. And below that is their little flag. This is Chabad's flag at that time. Notice the crown, King Mashiach. King Mashiach. So he is our latest false Messiah. Latest. When he died in 1996, a number of his followers expected him to, guess what? Raise from the dead. Exactly. And now the fervent followers of, not all of them, what's left of his followers say that he is living spiritually. You know, okay. So Davidic claimants are still with us. Yes. He never said it. He never specifically said, I am the Messiah. But he did just about everything possible to point to himself. Yes.
And David was a descendant of which of the 12 tribes?
Judah.
Oh,
Judah. Right. Okay. All righty. So claimants are still with us. There was a number of claimants in Jesus' day. What's the question? Which one has God chosen to be the King Messiah? And that's where the element of divine appointment comes in. Remember, there's two elements: Davidic descent, divine appointment. When Yeshua is conceived, the angel is going to tell Mary that her child, this child, and no other child, no other Davidic descendant, is going to be the King Messiah. This is the one. All right, let's finish up page 28. With the four titles in the middle, toward the bottom of the page. In these genealogies, four titles have been given. And these four titles present Yeshua's four basic states. The Son of David shows that he was a king. Son of David shows that he was a king. Son of Abraham shows that Jesus was a Jew. Jesus was a Jew. Son of Adam shows that Jesus was a man. He was a man, and the Son of God shows that Jesus was God. So you combine them all together, and the titles proclaim the picture of the Jewish God-man king. Jewish God-man king. Now let me close this section with a quote at the bottom of your page. It's an amazing Jewish tradition I ran across. This tradition states that the Messiah will have no father. And, of course, Jesus had no human father. This comes from the suffering servant of Isaiah, according to Jewish interpreters, page 33. It's the Breshit Rabbah, a commentary of Rabbi Moshe Hadashan. Says Rabbi Berechiah, the Holy One said to Israel, you have spoken before me, saying, we are orphans and have no father. The Redeemer, whom I shall raise up out of your midst, will have no father also. And guess what they use to substantiate that? Two messianic prophecies. They're speaking of the Messiah here. As it is said, behold, the man whose name is the branch, he shall branch up out of his place, Zechariah 6:12. Again, no father is mentioned. And similarly by Isaiah, and he will come up as a sucker before him, no father mentioned. And so when Jesus does not have Joseph as his father, he's being totally consistent with Jewish tradition. And this whole idea is fully in accord with Isaiah 7:14, which is the prophecy of the virgin birth. So all of this is in accord with New Testament genealogies and Old Testament prophecy and Jewish tradition as well. So the Messiah will have no father. All righty, let me call it quits right now. And I've kept you a minute and a half over. So let me pray and then I'll turn you loose. Father, again, I want to thank you for your word and how you so very carefully and specifically identify the Messianic King. And you hold us accountable to the promises you give us. You held Solomon and his line accountable, and they failed. But Nathan and his line, I must assume, Lord, followed the law resolutely and honored your law and honored your covenant, and therefore received the promise of the Messiah, a transfer over to Nathan's line. Thank you for godly remnant. A godly remnant in Nathan's line to maintain your messianic promise to David and to maintain your covenant. Thank you, Lord, for working it all out in all its intricate details and pointing out very specifically who the messianic person would be. So, Lord, when a Jewish person confronts us with this issue that maybe Jesus was illegitimate, maybe Jesus had Joseph was his father, maybe this, maybe that, help us to bring this information before them so that they can ponder what you have done and become convinced that Jesus is indeed our King Messiah. And so it's in his name that we pray. Amen. All righty, we'll see you next week.